Hello, welcome to the Farm Commons podcast, where we make farm law accessible and actionable for sustainable farmers and ranchers, as well as their networks of support. In each episode, we explore real legal issues faced on farms every day, providing key knowledge and tangible solutions to help you grow a thriving agricultural business. From managing liability to navigating tough conversations with landowners and neighbors, we've got your back. Let's get started. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Farm Commons podcast. Also, Happy New Year. This is our first episode of 2024. It's Eva here, and I'm hanging out with Rachel. It's been a while since we've recorded a podcast, so it feels pretty enlivening to be back on the air. How are you feeling, Rachel?
Well, I feel like this should be a winter podcast, but I don't know about you, Eva, but I haven't had much of a winter. It's been extremely mild, so I don't know. I think the good side is I'm already planting my gardens. I'm picking out my plants. I'm ready. So yeah, I'm ready for all things farming and farm law, of course.
Of course. Yeah, it's been pretty soggy over here. We missed a bunch of the snow that came through the southeast, which I think was supposed to, in non-El Nino years, go to you, got pushed down south, but we just missed it. And I am a snow lover. I really would love some. Weather gods, if you're listening, please send some our way.
You got a few weeks left, right?
Yeah, there's a chance for it to flip. Yes, there is hope. Well, in this episode, we will be discussing a new realm of farm law that we haven't really covered on the podcast before. And so this feels pretty exciting. If you grow herbs and if you make products with those herbs, you have been waiting for this moment too. And so this is going to be a conversation where we get into botanical product regulation. And this is the first in a three-part mini-series that we'll be recording on the podcast to build legal resilience for botanical producers. And so if you're wondering, what do you mean by botanical products and botanical producers? That may be because these products are more commonly referred to and marketed as herbal products. You know, your bulk medicinal herbs, herbal tea blends, herbal salves and vinegars, hydrosols, oxymels, and such. And so we're going to refer to these kinds of products as botanical products because that's how the law refers to them. So if you are growing herbs like yarrow, calendula, tulsi, ashwagandha, hyssop, and spilanthes, and drying those herbs for sale or producing products that you then sell, then you are a botanical producer. I should also mention that honey producers, you and garlic, maple syrup, and mushroom farmers, y'all can fall into this category too.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the title botanical producer can help us capture some of those other things that also go into these value-added products. We've got mushrooms, honey, garlic, beeswax, all sorts of ingredients that get prepared into products that have a health-minded objective, a claim that's attached to them. And when we do that, we have a different set of regulations that we have to follow than, say, selling vegetables and frozen meat or things like that. We have some new enforcement agencies that come into play, the FDA, the FTC. And so to get started, one of the first things we do is we start to think about botanical regulation in three broad categories. First, we talk about our regulatory categories. Then we talk about what are called structure and function claims. And it's okay if that doesn't mean anything right now. We'll help explain. And third, we address disclaimers.
Yeah, I think that's a great roadmap for our conversation, Rachel. And before we dive into the first part, being regulatory categories, I think it's helpful to have those regulatory layers named in terms of, you know, understanding who these enforcement bodies are and the rules that they're regulating, and they can come in layers. So Rachel just mentioned the FDA and the FTC. These are new enforcement bodies that we're talking about. You know, we're usually talking about the USDA and state departments of labor. But there's layers that are afoot here. And so when we're thinking about botanical products, there are faraway forces of regulation at the federal level. And there's also those closer to home, being municipal and depending on where you're at, tribal regulations. And just keeping this in mind that there are layers can help with just the mental picture that you're developing in terms of botanical product regulation. And before we, you know, dive into this topic of regulatory categories and regulation, I just want to name that it can feel overwhelming to, you know, learn about these regulations and be aware of who's enforcing them, and feeling like you need to keep up with all of this information. So we want to be really clear that we're not saying that you need to know, you know, what all the rules are and exactly what they say at every level, but rather we want you to be aware that these regulators exist and they do have power over you and your businesses. And so that's not to be scary, but to, you know, to be realistic and just name what is, because these regulatory agencies, they could take an enforcement action against your business if you aren't in compliance. And like I said, we're just naming the reality of it so that you can be prepared and take appropriate actions to, create a resilience plan. And so for boosting your resilience, we're going to, get into like three areas of botanical regulation that Rachel's going to get us into.
All right. So let's do it. So getting started in understanding how these botanical products are regulated, the first thing we need to talk about is what exactly are you creating? What are you cooking up? So, and I'm speaking, of course, to the producer. There's a few options we have. You might be making a food. You might be making a dietary supplement, or maybe a cosmetic, or maybe a drug. So four options, wide range. And let's give some examples. So let's take elderberries. You've got a basket of elderberries on your counter. You could cook them into a pie. And in that case, as you slice it, put it on a plate, and eat it with a fork, you know that's a food. But you could also turn those elderberries into a syrup, boil them down, mix it with honey, and use it as an immune-boosting supplement. That's not really a food, right? You don't like have it as part of a meal, and you're just taking it, you know, a spoonful or so. So that's our indication. But that's not the only thing. We could dry that elderberry. We could turn it into a powder and add it to a lotion for color, and that might make it a cosmetic. Or if we're breaking it down into chemical compounds and packing it in a capsule, it might be a drug. So the legal thing is the same. It was still a basket of elderberry, and we did something different with it. But the way that we're using it is what shapes its legal category. And these categories can like roll like a snowball right into one another. You know, we've got our botanical product that's a food or a dietary supplement or a drug, depending.
Yeah, it is. I just keep thinking of like shape shifting and that snowball taking all kinds of shapes. And to clarify, you know, let's take another herb, for example. If I grow mint and sell it for mojitos and as a salad ingredient, it's a food. But if I dry it and sell it as a tea, that calms the stomach, good to have after a meal. It might be a supplement or a drug, right?
That's exactly it. Nothing necessarily changed about the product. It's the same mint. Maybe it's fresh, maybe it's dried. You know, it's about how you're packaging it and the intentions that you are creating for how that product is going to be used that affects how it's regulated.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, intentions shape our communication and they also shape our botanical regulations. And this can get a bit confusing. And so to help producers get ahead of some of this confusion and mitigate it, can you share what factors determine what category a particular product would fall into so that our listeners can anticipate which category theirs might be?
All right, absolutely. So we've got two main factors that we're going to consider to start. And these are really commonsensical, but it's helpful to state them anyways. The first is form, and the second is ingestion. So let's talk about form. Food comes in a lot of different forms, right? We've got breads, vegetables, juices, syrups, tea. But we've got solids, liquids, flakes, all kinds of forms and physical attributes make up food. So for example, Tulsi tea, you could use it as a food and put it as an ingredient in a dish, but you could also put it into a capsule. So when we are examining what we're doing, we got to look at, well, what form is this thing in? Once we start putting something into it, you know, a tablet, a capsule, a soft gel, then it becomes pretty clear that we're not talking about a food anymore. And that leads us right into our second category that we're going to be thinking about. How is the product administered? By what means do you ingest or use this thing? If it's something that you spread on your skin, that's, you know, common sense is telling us that's looking like a cosmetic. If you chew it, you can bet you're pretty close to the food category. And if you swallow it or take it in small, you know, but powerful quantities, not as part of a meal, we're scooting towards the dietary supplement or the drug market, right? If you just drink it, well, it can get a little bit more complicated and we've got to start looking at other factors. So this form and ingestion, the modes by which that is happening, are going to give us some really strong clues as to whether we're talking about a food, a dietary supplement, a drug, or a cosmetic.
Yeah, and as the botanical producer who's choosing the form and describing the way to take it, the ingestion of it, this is all intention of the producer. And so I think it's worth adding that if you are a botanical producer, that the first place to start is with your intentions of the product. And so you can ask yourself, what category do you want your product to fall into? And then you can work backwards from there. And so, for example, if you want to sell your dried tulsi as a food in the regulatory sense, then you'll know not to grind it into, you know, dry it, grind it, and turn it into a soft capsule that you swallow and label it as a treatment for anxiety. If you want to sell your dried tulsi as a food, you'll leave it dried and tell folks that they can rehydrate it and add it into their favorite stir fry, which I know people do, and I've heard it's so delicious where I want to grow some tulsi this year and make a stir fry.
It sounds awesome. I personally am a big fan of herbs in my food and lots of them. So let's try not to get hungry right now.
Yeah. We got a lunchtime yet.
Right. Okay. So we've covered the form that the product is in and how it's supposed to be taken into the body. But there's another really big factor that helps us decide if something is a food, a supplement, a drug, or a cosmetic. And that is the claims we make about the item. So simply put, the things we say about the product influence how it is regulated.
Gotcha. And so I have a hunch where we're going here, and I think it's back to elderberries. Rachel loves elderberries, y'all, so all roads usually lead back there. And I personally don't know anyone who bakes them into a pie, although that might be good. Everyone I know around here in North Carolina is looking into elderberries for their immunity boosting value. And so folks use elderberries in syrups and teas to ward off sickness. And so is this where you're heading, Rachel? You know, if I as a producer say, hey, this elderberry syrup will improve your immune system. You know, it's winter time right now as we're recording and people are getting sick and someone may recommend elderberry syrup to feel better. Am I stumbling into a different regulatory realm?
You are right on the target, Eva. That's exactly it. And, you know, I do love elderberries. I have a few bushes outside right now. I've been eyeing them up. The deer spared them this winter. So I'm hoping for an abundant harvest. And if I take my elderberries and, you know, I cook them into syrup and I say to my customer, you know, elderberry syrup is amazing. Mix this up, put it on pancakes. Well, I'm not making a health claim about it. I'm just talking about it as a food and I'm saying it's delicious. But if I start saying, wow, elderberry syrup really helps the immune system, I have crossed a line into a different regulatory realm.
And so in crossing that line, do bad things just happen because you say that?
Well, no, it's not that bad things happen necessarily. Different things happen. They're bad if you don't want them. So different regulations come into play. I'll give you some more details here. So there are actually going to be two lines in front of us that we can step over. One is labeled the drug line, and the other is named the structure and function line. One of these has a bright red flashing bells and whistles, and it looks like you really don't want to cross it. Do you want to guess which one that is?
I'm going to say drugs.
Exactly. Exactly. You don't want to cross the drug line. If you do, you can imagine you're going to get regulated as a drug. So all of a sudden, the same rules that apply to someone who makes insulin or Tylenol or something like that, like you're going to have to comply with that. It's not something a farmer is going to want to do.
Oh gosh, no. I'm just imagining piles and piles of paperwork and money. So now I'm thinking about that other line that looks more appealing. And if I'm going to cross one of these two, and that's the structure function line. But I have some questions about that. You know, I can guess at what the drug line was about. You know, you just talked about insulin and Tylenol. So clearly, like pharmaceuticals, you know, we're bridging into that area of product. But I have no like real picture of what a structure function line is. In right. terms of like a product, you know. So do I want to cross this line?
You know, and so the structure function line, like that name is so horrible, structure and function or whatever. So we're still going to set that aside. And what I'm going to focus on as we get into this conversation is, yes, farmers can cross this line. This is something that any producer would be able to manage in their normal course of operations. It's not going to bring in, you know, overwhelming and ridiculously expensive regulatory rules and things like that. With a few changes to how you do business, most farmers can, you know, where the truth is on their side, of course, make a structure and function claim about their product. It is way more manageable than drug regulations.
Yeah, that's good to hear because, you know, I do, like I said, elderberry products are pretty popular here in North Carolina. And I do see people making claims about their elderberry syrup improving immune system, especially when, you know, elderberry syrup companies come to their local grocers and give out samples and they're like, here, it's good for flu season. So I'm going to, you know, through just seeing it happen, I'm going to say that and suggest that this is okay. They are allowed to say, these botanical producers, that, you know, elderberry syrup will help improve the immune system.
Yes. Yes. So, you know, as a general rule, we can't just look to what other people are doing and say that must be okay. But in this case, with qualifications, yes, folks are allowed to make those kinds of claims about elderberry syrup.
Okay, great, good. Celebrate with discernment. So you do your research, you see other botanical producers, you know, acting in ways that you feel called to act with regard to your products. So if this is allowed and they aren't being regulated as a drug, the elderberry syrup, then that must be the structure and function claim that you were talking about, Rachel, saying that the elderberry syrup improves the immune system. You know, this equals that, crosses the line into no longer a food, but into a dietary supplement because you're making this structure function claim.
Exactly. Exactly. That is the relationship between the structure and function claim. And you make that claim, it becomes a dietary supplement. So if we have an elderberry farmer who's having a hard time moving elderberry pancake syrup, she can say this syrup supports your immune system. But then all of a sudden, as soon as she makes that statement, her food converts into a dietary supplement, and then those rules apply.
Yeah, the picture is coming together. But you haven't said yet what the rules are. If the rules apply, what are the rules now that the farmer has to worry about now that they've decided to market their elderberry syrup for immune support?
Yeah. Let's talk about that. So let's say our farmer's name is Jill. The first thing that Jill needs to know is she can't go too far in terms of the claims she is making. She needs to stick to claims about the structure and function of the body. So that's where that name comes from. She can't cross the line into making drug claims, drug-related claims. So, you know, again, like, we need some more information. Where is that line? Jill cannot claim to treat, prevent, or cure any disease. She can't even refer to symptoms of a disease. So this is easiest to explain with some examples. So I'm going to talk about some, and we're going to go beyond the elderberry and immune system example for some broader ones. So here's a claim that someone might put on a product. This item promotes a healthy heart. That's a structure and function claim. It doesn't say it will treat, prevent, or cure a disease. It doesn't even refer to a disease. It doesn't refer to symptoms of a disease. It just says it will promote a healthy heart, which is a function of the body, the heartbeat. And so that claim is okay. In the elderberry example, saying something like it supports the immune system. The immune system is a function of the body, and we can say that the product supports that function. As long, of course, as we have evidence that it really does, and there is evidence out there that elderberry does support the immune system. So if you're going to say something promotes a healthy heart, well, you got to have a source for that. That's, you know, that's legitimate, but it's something that you can do. But let me give you a second example. If you can say that something promotes a healthy heart, can you say that that thing helps to stabilize the heartbeat? No, you cannot. Now, you're not referring to heart disease. You're not saying that it will treat, prevent, or cure any problem that the heart experiences, but it refers to symptoms of a disease. So this is a good example because folks can very innocently write a structure and function health claim and not realize that they are talking about the symptoms of a disease. And so that's really where we have to be careful. The prohibition against saying a botanical product can alleviate symptoms that are closely tied to a diagnosable condition, that's what we're getting at. That this is a diagnosable condition that, you know, now we're talking drug. All right. So the problem is that if we're saying that the product can stabilize an irregular heartbeat, then we're implying that there is an irregular heartbeat to begin with. And irregular heartbeats are a serious medical condition. So we can't start wading into that territory. So this is an impermissible claim, and the FDA could take action against us if we started to make claims like this. I got one more example for you, and this is a little more intuitive. Let's say I was going to put a label on my product that says it reduces the heart disease probability. No. Of course, I have said disease. I have said that I am, you know, claiming I'm alleviating, preventing, or curing it. So definitely can't do that.
Yeah, these are great examples, Rachel. Super clear of good, permissible structure function claims and bad or impermissible ones. And there is quite a bit of nuance in these claims. But hopefully as you listeners heard Rachel talk through the three different claims, from being positive, generally talking about what the body already does, you know, promoting a healthy heart versus helping to stabilize heartbeat versus reducing heart disease. Hopefully you're starting to get a sense of how these subtle differences in phraseology impact the legal regulations that apply. And so we actually encourage you to do a bit of homework and to start browsing the internet or the shelves of your go-to store where you purchase botanical products to get a sense of the structure and function claims that exist on the products out there. So just some ideas that come to mind, because I know I can find them at my local grocery store, the good old Food Lion. We have traditional medicinals, teas, puka, and yogi teas. And so I often will stop and just check out, you know, some of the structure and function claims on those tea boxes. And they do vary by company. So it's really interesting. So if you look at enough of them, you'll start to get to the point of identifying impermissible claims while discovering who put in the time to make, you know, quote unquote, safe ones or permissible claims. So yeah, I guess we've got our final key area of botanical regulation to discuss before wrapping up here. So I think we're on to disclaimers, right, Rachel?
Absolutely. Let's do disclaimers. Good news is that this is pretty straightforward. If you are creating a botanical product that falls into the category of a dietary supplement, so that means you've made a structure and function claim, you have to put a disclaimer on the package. And the disclaimer needs to say, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. And it has to be on the package. It must accompany the structure and function claim that you are making. And just so you know, there is not a pre-approval process where the FDA gives you their stamp of approval and is like, go ahead and make that claim. But you do have to let them know about the claim. And if they don't like it, you can bet they'll send you a letter saying that they don't. So do your research. Of course, the statement has to be true. So you want to make sure that that you're making a valid statement, and then let the FDA know that you're making it.
Yeah. Well, thanks for pulling us into the finish line, Rachel. In summary, when you're producing botanical products, you will want to be aware of what regulatory category those products fall under, you know, whether it's a food, dietary supplement, cosmetic, etc. And then the nature of the claims that you're making about the product, if it is meant to be a dietary supplement, to be sure that you aren't stepping into drug product category or realm. And then finally, have that required disclaimer that Rachel just mentioned that needs to be written on the packaging of all your botanical products if they're dietary supplements, with those appropriate structure and function claims. So as always, we'll leave you with some best practices and action steps to guide you forward. The best practice here is to adopt a marketing strategy so that you are not making improper claims about the health-related impacts of your botanical products. And a tip to prepare there is to work backwards from how you intend to sell your botanical products, you know, identifying whether you want to sell it as a food or a dietary supplement or a cosmetic. And then for action steps, we recommend reading our new Farmer's Legal Guide to Botanical Products to increase your understanding of permissible and impermissible claims. We'll link the direct webpage for this guide. It's a guide on our website, farmcommons.org. It's set up as an online book that you can browse through all the different chapters for all the legal issues that you will want to manage to build resilience for your botanical product business. It's an amazing guide written by our team of attorneys and educators, and has, yeah, just everything in there from botanical regulation to understanding zoning implications to making botanical products on your farm to employment laws, labeling, basically everything you need to know. And then your next action step is to review the FDA's website for past courtesy and warning letters to get a sense of, you know, what issue FDA has taken up with structure function claims, and just get a sense of what these letters look like so that if you do happen to receive one of these, it's not as much a shock. You know, you kind of have a sense of what the FDA is flagging and sending in these courtesy letters. And then finally, pay attention. The next time you're at a grocery store, check out the botanical products and see how they're packaged, how they're intended to be sold, what the labeling on the package says, and what the structure and function claims are. All right. Well, thanks, Rachel, and thanks everyone for tuning in.
Have a great rest of your day.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Farm Commons podcast. For more information on what you just heard, as well as a variety of farm law guides, checklists, flowcharts, and more, visit our website at farmcommons.org. You can also email us at info@farmcommons.org if you have any questions or comments about this podcast or any of our online materials. Thanks everyone for listening, and keep on growing.